You're listening to On Margins. I'm Craig Maude, and this is episode 9. Today we are talking with one of my very favorite writers, critics, and just overall human beings in this increasingly wacky, slightly disconcerting world of ours. Her name is Lynn Tillman. Lynn is the author of no fewer than 15 books. Her work jumps between fiction, nonfiction, novels, short stories, and essays. Her 2014 collection of essays, What Would Lynn Tillman Do?, was a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. On the title of that book, Lynn had this to say.
I guess some people would think, oh my God, what vaingloriousness. But, you know, but I never really associated it with me exactly. It's sort of just the concept. What would anybody do?
It's so disembodied. Yes. It's such a weird...
It's incredibly weird because, you know, it's not like, what would Jesus do?
Right.
I mean, here's this person who is unknown,
right,
except to maybe a couple of thousand of my readers or something, or people who know me. And so why would anybody care about what would Lynn Tillman do?
Lydia Davis blurbs for her. Paula Fox is an old buddy. Lynn is beloved. Lynn has one of the most creative and enthusiastically vexing minds of anyone I know. About Lynn, the Booker-winning Irish poet Colm Tóibín wrote, "She was wearing black. She had a glass of whiskey on the rocks in her hand. Her delivery was dry, deadpan, deliberate. There was an ironic undertone in her voice and a sense that she had it in for earnestness. Easy emotion, realism. She exuded a tone which was considered, examined, and then re-examined. She understood, it seemed to me, that everything she said would have to be able to survive the listener's intelligence and sense of irony. Her own intelligence was high and refined, her sense of irony, knowing and humorous. I had not come across anyone like her before." Lynn was kind enough to let me visit her at her East Village apartment, where she has been resident for over 30 years. We splayed all of her books out on the kitchen table and went through willy-nilly, grabbing copies and talking about covers. Now, do we start eating nuts and hummus halfway through? You bet we do. And before you go and get all judgy, go grab your own hummus. Grab your own nuts. Pour yourself a stiff cup of coffee. And come hang out with Lynn and me for the next hour or so. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hey, Craig.
Hey, Lenny. How you doing?
Fine. Great to see you. Come on in.
So, we have a lot of books on the table.
Yes, we do. Many, many, many. Perhaps too many. I want to start at the first novel.
Okay.
This.
Haunted Houses.
Haunted Houses. And this has a funny provenance,
okay,
in a way. It's Bret Easton Ellis's book, Less Than Zero, came out about a year before. And it's basically the same background as Less Than Zero. But... so this book came out in 1987.
Mm.
And about end of 1985, I said to the editor, this was at Poseidon, which was then part of Simon & Schuster, I said to the editor, my friend Barbara Kruger will do the cover for nothing.
Mm.
And she didn't know who Barbara Kruger was, and which was very odd because... Barbara had made a, you know, really big impression in the art world, but the literary world or the publishing world, which is actually different, really has no idea what's going on in the art world.
Right.
So they didn't use her work, which would have been free, and startling.
Yeah.
Startling.
This picture. Yeah.
I gave them a portrait that Nan Golden had given me, and they just cut the hell out of it.
Right.
And they didn't know who Nan Golden was either. They could have put quotes somewhere. They could have been a much bigger picture, beautiful picture, that Nan, a portrait of Nan, that Nan took of me in this old bar on 7th Street and Avenue B that Paul Newman's film, The Verdict, was some of it was shot there.
Oh, wow.
It was beautiful, the whole setting.
So it sounds like you how much of this were you seeing in the process of production, and how much of it was you getting the final book and being surprised?
I saw basically nothing.
Okay.
And I was very surprised. I did. They wanted, I don't know who this is, but because Haunted Houses has young girls in it in the first section.
Yeah.
They wanted, an older person, like she's 20 or 21. And then that's actually a picture of me.
Oh.
When I was at summer camp in kind of grimacing, which... the editor thought would be good because it's not just, it's a more complicated looking girl.
But look how uncurly the hair is, though.
I know. Isn't that funny?
It's amazing.
I guess my mother must have done something to it. Very interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, just, I mean, even your author photo, I mean, you've had such a consistent look.
Yeah.
For
a long time.
Yeah.
But you can't see how long that hair is.
Oh,
I mean, that,
I see.
This is really long. I had this... I wore this thing on my head.
You've always been proud of the volume of curls.
Yeah. Yeah. Volume is good, yes. Volume is good.
And so, but this was re-released recently, wasn't it? In the last 10 years by Red Lemonade.
Richard has not yet released it.
Oh.
Because of the, for one thing, the person doing the introduction hasn't yet done it.
Oh.
I will not say her name.
Okay.
So
we'll shame her.
Not to shame her. But no, this hasn't come out.
Oh, well, I have this image of this Haunted Houses cover with these three, maybe this is a different book, but three shots of you at different scales.
Did it come out again?
I feel like it did. I feel like there's
I thought not.
Because this is a book about three
girls, yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Am I losing my mind?
Maybe there was a Kindle edition that was put out that had this new cover.
Are you sure it was for...
Well, let's do a quick peek. Because this is so striking. And I was like, oh, yeah, these, the three women. And it's three...
He did. I don't even know if I have those here. He did. Which one? This is one.
Yep. Someday this will be funny. Yep. And it's in that. Yeah. Look at this. So.
God, I don't know where it. I guess I don't have it.
This is. It's really striking. Actually, I really love it. It's one of my favorite of the reissues.
Oh yes. So it was reissued. I just don't have a copy of it.
Isn't that amazing, though?
Yes, it is. The designer of all of the reissues that Richard did for Red Lemonade is, what is his name? Charles Orr.
Okay.
O-R-R.
And was Charles working with Soft Skull before? Or
No. It was when Richard wanted to do this, he talked with Charles Orr and I met him. And I was kind of... concerned. I didn't really want my face on all these.
Right.
And so they worked to make it so that it didn't feel too much like I was doing a kind of cult of personality business.
Sure.
And this one I like a lot.
Yeah, yes.
For Cast and Doubt.
Cast and Doubt. And this, and Doubt, this is the story of Helen and Horace.
Yes,
the Greek islands.
And the first cover,
yeah,
was so stupid. Look at that.
Well, it's a Greek island.
I mean, it really says nothing about the book. It's not that it's an ugly cover.
Right.
It just has no sense of its, for lack of a better word, hipness.
Right. Well, it's a. Yeah, I mean, we won't say who did it, but it's not ugly at all. But
It just doesn't tell you anything about the book. I would look at that and think, I wouldn't necessarily pick it up.
No. I mean, it's like if a novel is called The Man and you just had a picture of a stick figure of a man on the cover, cast in doubt on the islands. No, but this, the reissue is very,
yes.
I mean, how can you not be
yes.
you know,
yes,
pulled into
that
this?
Eye. Yeah, with that eye.
And whose eye is that?
That's my eye.
Oh. Oh, look at that.
So the photographer, he shot in color and black and white, and a lot of makeup was put on me. I mean, not huge amounts, but yeah. I was so bored, and the lights were so harsh.
Yes.
And I shouldn't complain, because Richard set this whole thing up, and Charles Orr, but the makeup at a certain point caked in.
Okay.
And they said, do you want to do it over? And I said, no. So I think there was a lot of photoshopping.
I see. Okay. Well, it's so striking.
Yeah.
This is very interesting. So this cover, Charles Orr's idea was to kind of do this, photograph your face somehow.
Yes.
This is all part of the Red Lemonade series, the reissues.
That's right.
And it seems like it was a conscious decision to put your face on everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not everything, not cornflakes.
Yeah.
But this whole series, that's right. And I don't know where motion sickness is. And I obviously don't have a copy of the new issue, new edition of Haunted Houses, and didn't remember.
Well, in motion sickness too, I'm trying to remember how that...
And for that, David Yulin did the introduction. And for Cast in Doubt, it was the wonderful Wayne Kustenbaum. And of course, David Yulin is also a wonderful person.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it didn't pop up. The type treatment on this is really curious, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Cast in Doubt.
It's elongated and very narrow.
Yeah.
And my name is in somewhat smaller than the title, which is good. I prefer the title being larger than the name.
Yeah.
But I think it's very well designed, with it having the eye so prominent, and then the title to the right of it.
Yeah.
Which I think looks really unusual. The skin tone is nice.
The skin tone's fine. Well, and also the way it's projected onto the face.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of...
Yes.
So it doesn't feel, it doesn't feel like two disembodied pieces. It feels like a whole up there.
Right.
But it's really fascinating how there's this whole, like, branding that,
yes.
that Red Lemonade built around the name Lynn Tillman.
That they wanted to... Richard wanted it all to have the same look,
yeah.
and to have my face on it. And I was, as I said, reluctant.
Right.
And so when this one came out...
Someday this will be funny.
It was right side up. And I said, please turn it upside down.
Oh, okay.
Because having the title, Someday This Will Be Funny, on top of my face in a regular portrait way... just struck me as perhaps a kind of self-critique I wasn't ready for.
It's sort of like an unvirtuous fortune cookie or something.
That's right. Yeah.
But even this is I really love. I mean, this is all Charles Orr.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really.
He did a wonderful job. He's a good designer.
So much of it is, I think, the tones.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I mean, so much of the writing is also tone related.
Well, we know why it's not published in Japanese.
The tone. It is, but that's, I mean, I think that's really fascinating that you have spoken with Japanese translators, and they have kind
one.
Of... They've won. They've won, and they've said, but a very good one.
Very good.
A very talented one, and the tone was...
It's
complicated
said,
to pull over. Yeah.
That's right. He said that there were too many changes of tone within the same sentence. And that is true. I understand
true.
That. I never thought that this would stop me from being translated in Japanese, but apparently it hasn't.
But I mean, honestly, it would be a massive undertaking, I think, to get that, to nail that in Japanese, because there is not, you know, those shifts aren't there usually.
But there's irony in Japanese work. Recently, Argentina, the complete Madame Realism and other stories is going to be translated into Spanish and come out in Argentina. And that is this book. The complete one just came out in 2016.
Oh, but the Madame Realism,
the very first
one.
First one was 1992.
Okay.
And I don't know where that is.
It's
I know it's there. I know it's there. And this is a cover. This image is from the artist Louise Lawler.
Mm.
And Hedy El Kalty, who manages Semiotex, is himself an artist and designer, and he designed the cover. And Louise Lawler, she gave the image. She's a good friend. And there were just, I think, certain requirements of hers was that the image not be despoiled or something.
Yeah.
So, and I think they did a good job.
And how do you feel about this connecting with the book itself?
With the statues. Yeah. I think there's why I love it is that I think there's something about Madame Realism, the character. It's not that she's a statue, but she is in each story. I mean, it's her story, and any one of these could imagine as a figure for her. Not that that's how I see her, but it just struck me, here are these different female figures, these sculptures.
I see these are all women, yeah.
Yeah, they're all women. And I just like the idea that Madame Realism as a character, she's a figure. She's a figure of speech in a way. And these are figures, these in, I guess, whatever, marble, I suppose.
Very interesting. The semiotext.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of, there's this pattern of a lot of reissuing of some of your original stuff.
That's right. So the first Madame Realism, which also came out from semiotext, had about 5 or 6 Madame Realism stories, or as many as I'd written then, like 7, and some other stories. So it was not strictly, that's why I called it the Madame Realism Complex, because it wasn't just Madame Realism. And then when they finally ran out of the book, I mean, after 20 years, something like that, ran out of copies, Hedy said, do you want to, you know, reissue it? And I said, well, there are a lot more Madame Realism stories. Ah. So why don't we do the complete one and then threw in some very recent stories, too, toward the end.
How many more were
added? I think there was, how many more? I think there are, God, how many? 16 or 17 Madame Realism stories. And, of course, just to be perverse, what did I do? I've written another Madame Realism story, so now it's incomplete.
When did you write that?
I wrote that not this summer, a summer ago.
Mm. And what's the page 69 rule?
Is there a page 69 rule?
I thought you had a rule about opening a book to page 69 and reading and finding if there was something interesting or not.
No.
No. Okay.
You must be mixing me up with somebody.
No, I read your interview with 3AM magazine.
Did I say page 69?
There's a section. Maybe the interviewer invented the rule.
Invented. I don't remember everything.
But I'm looking at page 69 here, and it's you know, this line: "Focus, Madame Realism demanded of herself. Concentrate. She couldn't find her reading glasses." And what a great author photo on the back of this book.
Well, someone called Craig Maud took it when I was unaware he was taking it.
Oh.
I didn't know that you were. Did I know you were taking the pictures?
A little. I think I'd been snapping away periodically throughout the coffee.
And was it so coffee?
It was coffee with Richard. Was there? Richard.
That was.
Yeah, we were in the back of of Richard's club.
Oh my! You know what I? That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then we did some shots also at the cafe in the West Village.
Yes.
But those didn't turn. The light wasn't as good.
I see.
The light was very good for this.
Oh, I was thinking, isn't that funny?
What was
the name of that restaurant we went to? It was really good, and we sat outside.
Yep, on the sidewalk.
And it was lovely.
Yeah.
It's a famous restaurant. Ambrosia? No. Something like that.
But the light was, it was just too harsh. Yeah. And this was in the back of the Norwood.
That's right. What were you shooting with? What?
I was using a black and white, it only shot black and white, the digital camera, tuned to just be a black and white sensor. Yeah, and I had just gotten it, actually, and so that's why I was, you know, excited and photographing a lot.
Have you always been interested in photography, or is this relatively new?
Always, always.
Always?
Yeah, and I could never afford a camera when I was young. So I'd wanted one when I was 15, 16, 17, mm-hmm. but there's just no way to afford it. Mm-hmm. And when I first went to Tokyo when I was 19, I saved up and bought... I basically taught myself photography online. There was a forum mm-hmm. that was very active. And you could learn everything. It was just, you know, this sort of autodidactic situation. There's sort of that platonic ethos of what the web can be, you know, where all information is open and you can learn from people. And it really was. I mean, I spent hundreds of hours reading these forums about photography, about how to use slide film and, you know, how to think about exposures and which bodies to buy and which lenses to use.
Did you do that with the other subjects as well?
Everything. Yeah, lots of design, all of the technical stuff that I've done was also sort of self-taught, all the web stuff. I mean, that's kind of just how I feel like I grew up in a generation where a lot of what was happening online couldn't be learned any other way than just getting messy.
Because
getting
it was being created as it was going along.
Yeah, and I mean, at university I was in, you know, computer science courses, but they were theoretical mathematics courses there's nothing pragmatic about it. So any of the actual doing and making, you had to kind of learn on your own. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of that moment. You know, I think now you can probably learn more in a vocational way at university for that stuff. But
you know, bringing out anthologies of my writing, that's important to me. And the reason why collections, because a lot of my writing goes into obscure places.
Right, right, right.
And it is a way for me, if I'm writing essays for a catalog for a private foundation, no one ever sees it except the artist or the institution.
Right.
And so bringing them all together is... you know, just a very solid way of letting people know what you've been doing for the past 10 years or something with these shorter works.
Well, and there's something important about that adjacency, too, of all these things sort of next to each other and, you know, and reading them in that way.
I could tell you a little bit about this book, What Would Lynn Tillman Do? Or do you want to go back to, you had some idea about something else you wanted to say?
Oh, no. Well, I was just going to say, with this image, I think part of why also... I think it works.
The picture you shot of me, I've been using it everywhere. it's absolutely magnificent.
Okay. But I think part of why it works so well is because Richard was nearby, and we were getting the glowing warmth of Richard in the courtyard.
Yes. The spectacular Richard Nash is the person we're talking about.
I think that was...
Well, we were all in a very good mood, too.
It was good.
We were happy to be together.
It was, and it was nice out. It was beautiful.
Yes. And that does bring me to What Would Lynn Tillman Do, because Richard published this.
Yes. Someday This Will Be Funny.
What would Lynn Tillman do, and American Genius of Comedy were all published by him.
How did that relationship appear? What was that? I don't know that connection.
American Genius of Comedy ultimately came out in 2006. Mm. I finished writing it, I guess, at the end of 2004, early 2005. And then it went on the market. Mm. And it's not the usual book. I don't really write the usual novel. And it went only to 5 publishers, editors, one of whom was Richard.
I see.
And I had heard that Richard was very interested in publishing me. And the 4 other editors that it was sent to all rejected it happily. I'm so glad they rejected it because it created a moment for me to meet Richard and you know, my career, I don't think it would be hideous, but it would be nowhere without Richard's touch. Mm. I mean, he really changed my publication possibilities and the way in which I'm seen. He made many, many things possible. So American Genius, a comedy, he said he wanted to publish it. He was quite nervous about how I would respond to his edits. Mm. And I think he'd had some poor experiences with other writers. And it made me very nervous that he was nervous because I'm thinking, what is he going to do? Right. But in fact, he's more of a line editor than he is a macro, you know, it's more micro. Yeah. And that worked beautifully for American Genius, a comedy, because I was playing with very long sentences.
Right.
And what created the, you know, what cemented our relationship was that he sent me the edits. And I thought it'd be so much easier just to do it with him, go through it with him. And they were not Herculean problems or whatever at all. So I said, why don't I come to your office? He said, no. He said, I'll come to you on a weekend because we'll have more time and I won't be interrupted. So he came over on a Saturday, and I guess he got here at about 11 a.m., and we sat on the couch in the front next to each other, and I guess he didn't leave till about 7:30 at night. And we sat on the couch going through all of his comments, and it wasn't massive at all, but it was very specific. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I almost refused to use dashes. And he wanted me, he said, and there are a lot of commas in American Genius of Comedy. And I love commas. And I, you know, people are getting rid of them. I don't know why, but I do know why. They think it's not necessary. And I think commas are necessary. So that helps create the rhythm. You are letting the reader know where a slight pause is.
Sure.
So I gave him some dashes, you know. We went from, and also when he said, you know, I really would love another sentence here. This is so interesting. You know, would you expand on that? So I went over to my computer and I wrote another sentence and I'd come back, print it out and I'd say, read it to me, would you? And he would read it in this wonderful Irish accent. Yes. But he got the rhythm right.
Yeah.
He knew exactly.
Yeah.
And that's in part because he did theater. You know, he went to Yale and he was in theater and directing. And so we had such a good time.
Yeah.
And I'd never done anything like that before with an editor, and that was it. And then I knew it was going to be a long time before I had another novel ready, because the idea that I had would ensorcel me for many years, and it did. And so I said,
which was Men and Apparitions.
Men and Apparitions, yes. And I said, you know, Richard, it's going to be a long time. Why don't we do some short stories?
Yeah.
So then he did Someday This Will Be Funny. And that came out in 2011, which is 5 years after American Genius of Comedy.
Right.
And then 2014 comes around, or 2013. I said, well, why don't we do, I have so many essays.
Right.
Why don't we do an essay collection?
Right.
And that was, what would Lynn Tillman do?
Yeah.
And the amazing thing about the title,
yes,
What Would Lynn Tillman Do, was that the story on that is that Stephen Fraley, who was the head of undergraduate, head of the chair of the undergraduate photography department at SVA, School of Visual Arts, mm-hmm, he had started a magazine called Dear Dave.
Yeah.
And unbeknownst to me, at some point, he decided that he wanted to use as his advertising campaign this blue page that he put into every issue. He didn't tell me. I had no idea.
Yeah.
This was a big surprise. And when I opened up the magazine, here's this blue page with white letters. I mean, it wasn't this. It was with white letters saying, what would Lynn Tillman do? And in the gutter of the magazine, it said, subscribe to Dear Dave. So...
Yeah, I love that he just used your name without even asking.
I mean, he knew I would enjoy it. I guess some people would think, oh my God, what vaingloriousness. But, you know, but I never really associated it with me exactly. It's sort of just the concept. What would anybody
it's
do?
It's so disembodied. It's such a weird...
It's incredibly weird because, you know, it's not like, what would Jesus do?
Right.
I mean, here's this person who is unknown, to, except to maybe a couple of thousand of my readers or something, or people who know me. And so why would anybody care about what would Lynn Tillman do?
Well, and then it transformed into this strange poster campaign around
That's
the city.
Right. That's right. And before the book came out, Stephen Fraley just decided he wanted to publicize Dear Dave.
Yeah.
And suddenly these posters were going up, and they went up exactly at the time that Richard and I were putting together the table of contents and thinking about what we should title it.
Right.
And Richard said, it's a slam dunk.
Yeah.
It's got to be What Would Lynn Tillman
Obvious.
Do?
Yeah. And then this became the National
Book Critics Circle Awarding Criticism.
Yes.
It was a finalist.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Fantastic.
I lost to Ellen Willis, who had died many years before, but had never gotten one. And there was a posthumous collection of her work. So, I lost to a
dead person.
A dead person. A very, important rock critic and all of this. It reminds me of what Spike Lee said recently when he lost at the Oscars, and he should have won for Black Klansman. I loved that movie. And The Green Room is just not there's two good actors in it, but it wasn't Black Klansman. It wasn't anything like it. Not inventive, and Spike Lee is so inventive. And he said they were comparing the Green Book to Driving Miss Daisy, and he lost to Driving Miss Daisy, and he lost to the Green Book. And he said, I always lose when there's somebody being driven. Anyway, so what's interesting about this collection in the way that it was put together with Richard was that we decided to do it as an abecedarian, the table of contents. And so then rather than grouping them under some subtitle, we just did it alphabetically. A is for Andy Warhol. B is for the Bowleses, Jane and Paul. C is for character. C is for cool. We had two for C. D is for the dictionary. Yeah. And these all refer to pieces of mine about these subjects.
Yeah. Well, and there's the interview with Peter Dreher in there.
Yeah, Peter Dreher.
Four interviews. Where you? So I'm just checking to make sure your mic is still on, because that's the interview where you recorded with Peter and got home and the tape was blank.
My tape was completely blank, and I had to go back and redo it with him.
But it was a good second.
Yes.
Second. Well, do you feel it was better?
You know, they were very different. It was much harder to get it started.
Okay.
The second time around, and then he said, "Did you plan this?" Because his work is about
repetition. Yeah. Well, what would Lynn Tillman do is also and I don't even know if you know this, but this entire book is online now.
Oh.
The whole thing.
Oh.
So, you know, Richard and I made a website.
For it.
For the book. We did this a long time ago. Did you know this?
Well, I think I did, but I haven't thought about it.
So, yeah, there's nothing to think about. If you go to whatwouldlynntillmando.com, when the book came out, part of the promotional campaign we had concocted, I was just sort of spitballing stuff with Richard. We put this website together to just put up one of the essays a week and then promote each essay each week. And Richard had put them all into the system, and then it just sort of petered out. I think he got to about D, and then that was it. And so it was just stuck at D. It went A, B, C, D up until about 3 months ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then Richard messaged me, and he said, "Hey, it's costing a lot to keep this thing up. Do you know if there's a way to do this that's not so expensive?" And I said, sure. And what we did is I made, Richard, I said, "Richard, do you have all this stuff in there?" And he said, "Yeah." And so he pushed it all up, published it all. And then I made a static copy of it. So I archived it in this way that's, so with websites, they're either dynamically made. So they're generated whenever someone looks at it by going to a database. And it's very complicated. So it's this thing. It's unnecessarily complicated for most things. And so what I did is as an archivist, I created a static version of it that requires no database at all. So I kind of froze it, and then I cloned it on my servers, and Richard was able to get rid of his thing. And so I'm hosting it now, the entire thing.
Oh, thank you.
And it'll be up. It's archived with the Internet Archive and all these nonprofits. So it's
that's fantastic. Yeah, how much was it costing him to keep it?
Oh, I don't know, but it was hundreds of dollars a year, some silly thing. But it was just unnecessary.
Unnecessary. How interesting.
But so I thought that was really fun about this book as well. And with the website, we riffed directly off this blue poster, and so the website, the typography, everything is connected with this cover. And I think it's really important. Today more than ever, I think, with digital and physical and this kind of bouncing between those two worlds, to create these strong brands, these strong visual connections between the objects and then how they live online.
It's funny, you use the word brand so easily, and for me it's very hard.
I try not to, it's so dirty. I know it's such a dirty, weird way to look at it, but I don't see it as a pejorative word in this context. I see it as a way to help readers connect a disparate set of things. And so,
do you think of yourself as a brand?
I try not to, but there's, you know, we have this image of like Tide is a brand. What does Tide mean? How do you make Tide this, you know, evoke these feelings of cleanliness or whatever? And
you asked Mr. Clean to come over and use Tide.
Exactly. but, you know, speaking with Jonathan Gray, who did Zadie Smith's covers and, you know, Forer's covers, and those covers created constellations, visual constellations that I think are closely associated with the authors. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about that, because books can be so ephemeral, and that the best kind of design work helps, even if the covers are different, you know, they aren't exactly the same, it helps draw a line around all the work in a way that I think elevates the work and is kind to the readers.
I'm just thinking about historically, if what books I whose covers I began to associate with the author.
Right.
And I remember one of the first Hemingway books I read was The Sun Also Rises.
Yeah.
And I think it had a very strong cover, the paperback that I read.
Yeah.
And of course, now I don't remember it, but it was, there was something about it. I could never forget the title.
Yeah.
And Hemingway was like the sun rising, that kind of thing. Then,
yeah.
I still like that book, although I don't like a lot of Hemingway, but I do like that book. I feel sorry for the guy.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to him, he had many, many regrets. Okay, so now,
this is interesting.
Yes.
Because we've been talking a lot about novels. What Would Lynn Tillman Do was your criticism and nonfiction
right.
stuff. And then here is this is kind of an aberration in your... Right? It's outside of...
Well, I don't know why I would call it an aberration, but it's atypical. I've done three or four nonfiction books, an essay collection, and The Velvet Years, which I can bring out. But this book, Bookstore, it was supposed to have been something that was the 20th anniversary of this famous bookstore in New York City called Books and Company.
Mm-hmm.
And I signed on to do it. This was shortly after I'd finished No Lease on Life. And so that was 1997, 96, 96. I finished it. The book didn't come out, No Lease on Life, a novel, until 98. Okay. There was a big gap. And so, I was asked if I would be interested in writing about Books and Company just for their 20th anniversary,
mm-hmm.
to do something that was like The Velvet Years, which was based on doing oral histories.
Yeah.
I said yes. I signed the contract, and boom, the store is going to close in 2 months or something like that. Or 2 months after I signed the contract, the store was closing. The Whitney had the lease, the Whitney Museum of Art. And
where was this located exactly?
This was on Madison Avenue between 75th and 74th Streets.
Okay.
So the Whitney is there.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at the Whitney, you go to the right, two stores down from the Whitney, there's Books and Company.
Yeah.
And it was a major independent bookstore. Major, not that it was huge, but that it really had one of the best selections of contemporary fiction. And that was because of the manager. What was supposed to have been an 8-month project turned into a 3-year thing. And yes, in a way for me, it was an aberrant experience. I had never done something like this, and I was first commissioned by the person who owned the bookstore, Jeanette Watson. But then word got around after I had completed the manuscript, and Harcourt Brace was interested in it. And they bought it. And this drawing that's on the cover is by Saul Steinberg.
Mm.
And he had made this drawing for Jeanette, because he also was somebody who had used the bookstore a lot. And the bookstore had 2 or 3 readings every week.
Okay.
And it really was a center and a place. I didn't go to it that often, except because I was living downtown and right. I would go to St. Mark's bookstore for
sure.
my books.
Sure.
So I suggested that this be on the cover.
Fantastic. Well, it's beautiful. I mean, it feels like
it's I think it's exactly right. I would have even probably had it somewhat bigger.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And I interviewed 70, 80 people for this. It is a kind of cultural history. I wouldn't say a kind of, it is a cultural history.
Yeah.
And what I realized was, and maybe Craig, this is part of your methodology also, I thought to myself, how does a bookstore run?
Mm.
You know, because when you're a kid and you go into a bookstore, you think every book in the world is there.
Right.
And when you go into a bookstore and they don't have a book, you think, how could they not have that book?
There's so many.
There's so, yes, and how could they not have that? And so I decided I would do like almost like an ethnographic study of a bookstore. The buyers, the salespeople who come in, how they talk.
So you were not privy to kind of the way these things functioned up until this project, before this.
Yeah.
You'd never worked at a bookstore part-time.
No.
You'd never, yeah.
No, never.
No friends who ran bookstores.
No.
No. You just, you'd pop into St. Mark's bookstore and
a lot of
look
time.
At things and then,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't know really the mechanics of it. And it was very interesting to me. So what I did was I interviewed all the people who make the bookstore function and learned about why things are in the window, or that in Barnes and Noble, the books up front aren't necessarily the best books, but
sure.
the books that publishers pay for to
sure.
put there. I didn't know that.
I know. It's a secret.
It's a big secret. That's a big secret.
But it's so powerful. That's
it
why.
It's very, very powerful.
That's why. Well, I mean, I think they won't put anything. Mm-hmm. There has to be some affection
that's
for the book.
And at Barnes & Noble, there was some, there used to be some distinction between the different stores in different neighborhoods.
Right. Oh, interesting.
So
was there?
And the curator or whoever it was at the store, well, this is the East Village, so we'll put, you know, something out there by an East Village writer,
right.
something like that in front. And other places did that too. So it.
How funny.
And then I think it did become more uniform as time went on.
Well, because the image of Barnes & Noble, I think it has a very funny image right now, because it's, I feel like I wasn't old enough when it first hit to understand its impact on the local ecosystems.
Yeah.
But from, I think, what is it? You've got Mail? Is that the,
yes.
is that the bookstore
that's
movie?
Right.
It was the thing, it was this demon thing
right.
in
that's
the early 90s, wasn't it?
That's right.
And it was sort of the Amazon of its moment.
That's right.
And so my image of it has always been of this kind of like bland nothingness that would just come in and stomp out the local. But I guess by selection and cheap prices, is that what was?
Well, there was, yes, yeah, some of that. The other thing is that Len Riggio, who's the owner of Barnes & Noble, he plugged into something, which is that people come out of college, they're 21, 22, they're going to be looking for jobs in cities and stuff. Why not make a bookstore feel like a college campus cafeteria
yeah.
and lounge?
Yeah.
So suddenly there are these lounge areas.
Yeah.
You can sit and read. You can sit and read.
I remember how progressive that felt
yes.
in the where you almost felt, am I allowed to take this book over there and
that's right.
just read it?
That's right.
Even if I don't buy it?
And that I think was really, who reads books? You know, you read books in college
yep.
and hopefully you're going to continue to read when you come out.
Yep.
But you're also suddenly without your ecosystem, which had the library, had the cafeteria. It was all there.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I didn't talk to him about this, but as soon as I saw those things, I thought, oh, this is for people who've just gotten out of college.
Right, right, right.
And it was very smart.
Right.
It was very, very smart. And, yeah, it did knock out a lot of smaller
yeah.
bookstores. And now they're coming back again.
The smaller bookstores.
Smaller yes. bookstores, yeah.
Well, I think because exactly to your point of like Books & Co.,
yeah.
they function as these community hubs for the community, for the literary community.
And people do, so you can meet people in bookstores.
Yeah.
You can't, I mean, you can meet people online and hook up and that kind of stuff, but this is a different kind of meeting,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And then you feel, well, you know, I might meet somebody who's also a writer and
right.
maybe, you know, those kinds of things.
Well, there's a lot of self-selection going on.
Yes.
You know, of the clientele.
Yes.
I'm always shocked. I mean, whenever I'm in town, I'll buy something. I'll go to Three Lives & Co. or McDonald Jackson or Mass or, you know, something like that. I mean, Mass is its own special thing. But I'll pick up a novel and I'll go and check out, and they'll be like, all right, sir, that'll be $30. And you go, oh my God, that's right. Books cost $30. Like, we've sort of been reprogrammed in a way because of Amazon that $12 or $15 or maybe $20 is kind of the ceiling. But the reality is that, for this ecosystem to function properly, they kind of have to sell at about $30 at these bookstores. But it feels good to pay that.
Yes, I mean you are sort of bankrolling.
Well, and I think you could go, well, what about people who don't have money? Well, that's why libraries exist. So it doesn't feel like it's an either or. It feels like all bases are covered. And I think in the last few years especially, we've understood how important independent institutions are.
Yeah.
And are willing to go and pay that.
Right.
This cover, did you have, your input was mainly
we use that drawing?
And how did you come across that drawing?
Well, she had it up in the bookstore.
Oh, okay.
It's much larger. And he just did it one day and gave it to her.
Okay.
And what's interesting is there's the Whitney, which is much bigger, but the bookstore is what was more important to Saul Steinberg. And another thing that was interesting was that since the Whitney was pulling the plug on the lease for the store, there was a real division between the people who went to the Whitney a lot and didn't care so much about the bookstore and the bookstore people and the books people. And some of them were so unbelievably conservative about art.
Oh.
I mean, that was really strange. They might be reading really great stuff, but the idea of modern art, as they still called it, I hate that stuff anyway. How could they do that? And I didn't, it's very interesting about doing a history. Because I've written essays about this, how you're excluding.
Yeah.
There is no way to include everything.
Sure.
And so the historian of whatever type is deciding what is most interesting.
Yeah.
And what I didn't want to do was have a lot of negative gossip in there, because that stuff doesn't last. It might be interesting for a few years, but it has no legs. And there's no reason to do it.
Right.
So there were a lot of attack. People, when I was interviewing them, would say terrible things about the Whitney, or the director then was David Ross, and they would, make accusations about David Ross and stuff. I put none of that in.
Well, I think that's a really mature impulse that we've lost today.
Well, I think that's true. I don't know how mature I was, but I was thinking about what is it that interests me. It's not gossip.
Yeah.
I may gossip with a friend or something that. But what I realized was, so I was at McDowell working on this and crying, because it was not an easy... It wasn't what I wanted to be writing.
Right.
And I had this whole system. It was when anybody said something about Jeanette's father, who was IBM, all of the stuff about Jeanette's father I'd put in one file.
Okay.
And I had to be cross-referencing back and forth. It was very administrative doing this book.
I mean, do you think this is the largest sort of research-related book that you've done? I mean, the amount of data that you collected and synthesized.
Yeah, I would guess so. Although I recently wrote an essay about Ankhawara.
Okay.
And I had to do a lot of research for that.
But not
3 years worth.
So you were crying because it was at McDowell in your beautiful cabin.
Yes, and every morning I would walk down the thing and I'd say, I can't do this. And my analyst said to me, of course you can do it, you just don't want to do it.
Did it feel like homework?
Yes, it did. It did.
You felt a duty to...
Of course.
Yes.
I had agreed to do it. I was paid to do it. And I wanted to do it very as well as I could. There were a couple of things that I did was, and Jeanette gave me the money to do it, which was I hired somebody to do a Bibli, to do a complete list of all the readings that had been there and all the books that had been read from and all the publishers. So in the back of the book, you see that there is 20 years of what was going on in the literary world, who was reading. It's helpful to scholars who might be interested in what was, and many of the publishers are gone because they were in prints and, and they're just gone. And the other thing I did was have a name index at the back of the book so that if somebody was interested in reading about one person rather than another, they could do that. And I think that that makes this a richer research project or a book to read for people who do want to do more research in, you know, what was the literary world like in between 1977 and 1997. And so that was done. And I did an introduction that talked about the history of bookstores in America. And yeah, so I did my job. Yeah. Yes, I did. Oh, so when I was at McDowell putting all of this together, I realized I didn't interview David Ross, and he was the director then of the Whitney. Oh. And I immediately wrote him a letter when I come back because I wanted his point of view. I realized there was no one from the Whitney who'd said anything.
Right.
And so I interviewed him, and he has his say in the book.
Right.
But he's not attacking anybody,
right.
You know, or if he said anything that was attacking or... I didn't use it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I said a mature impulse, but like a wise impulse, because realizing that it doesn't... It's just not interesting in a historical, on the longer arc. But I feel like social media today inspires...
Yes, yes.
This sort of the smallness of time, the thinking. You know, it's social media is all about the next 20 seconds.
It's impulsive.
Yeah.
There's a lot of just impulsiveness and reactiveness.
Yeah.
Both things are not particularly wonderful for society.
Well, it's funny how the book as a form kind of inspires the opposite of that.
Right? Yes.
You know, sort of understanding what this is going to be in 20, 30, 40,
yes.
100 years.
Yes.
And so this came out in the 90s.
Yeah. 99.
And No Lease on Life.
It came out in 98.
It came out, okay, but were you writing this in tandem with Bookstore?
No, I had written it before.
Okay.
I'd written it before, and it was sold to Harcourt Brace. And, I mean, this is a nice cover, but I wanted something else. I wanted something that I considered much more edgy.
Sure, sure. So this is, I mean, for listeners, this is a book. Do you want to give a summary of it? I mean,
it's a novel that's 24 hours in a young woman's life. She lives in the East Village.
Right.
And I was kind of riffing on Joyce's Ulysses, of walking around 24 hours in the city,
right.
as Bloom does. And, but mine would have a female walker in the city,
right.
Elizabeth.
Yes,
and
who loves jokes?
Who loves jokes? But she doesn't tell any of those jokes. What I realize, if I'm going to do a book about New York City, it needs jokes.
Yeah, okay.
Because the city, to me, is a place of great humor.
Right.
This city.
Right.
And people who live here have the idea that they themselves are funny, and they can tell good jokes and all of that. And I knew all these jokes for many years and would tell them, which was something that women really didn't do.
Right.
And I would like to do it because women weren't supposed to tell, you know, be the bearer of the joke.
Right.
You were supposed to be the object of the joke. And then I collected even more jokes from musicians.
Yep.
Who, on their breaks between sets, tell each other jokes.
Right, right, right.
You know, like minstrels, yeah, going from one castle to another.
And what's interesting is you said earlier that you were anti-dash, mm-hmm, you know, M-dashes, but all the language in here, all the conversations are set off with dashes.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I liked it for that.
Yeah.
And the conversations, which I think most people didn't realize when the book came out, are based on interviews I did with three people. They are interviews that I recorded, and then I excerpted different things so as to have that being part of the narrative of the book.
I mean, the book starts with clap, clap, clip, clap, clip, clap, bang, clip, clap, clip, clap, bang, bang, clip, clap, clip, clap, bang, clip, clap, clip, clap, bang, bang, what's that? I don't know. An Amish drive-by shooting. And then the first sentence was, they were just fucking around. They yelled and ran, overturned garbage cans on her block. No, it's, so yeah, I mean, the book, the East Village in this moment was edgy. Yes. I mean, I used to drive down here when I was 16. So we were only a block or two away from each other in 1996.
Oh, really?
When I would drive down. And I'd go to Coney Island High on St. Mark's Place.
Oh, yes.
And I used to play drums with the reggae night.
Oh, there. No, you're kidding.
Yeah, and I didn't do drugs. I did drums, but because there was so much weed being smoked in that room,
you would be stoned out of your
mind. There's no way to not. But I don't know why. I thinking back on it, it was insane that I would drive. I had this little Honda Civic, and would just drive from Hartford down into New York City. And
that's 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Oh, three and a half. Yeah. I'd leave at 8 or 9 PM at night from Hartford and get here at midnight. And I don't even know where I put the car, and you know, who knows what was going on. But back then, when I think about the difference in danger level of the East Village in the mid-90s compared to now, obviously.
Well, crack in the 80s was terrible.
Yeah.
And it really destroyed. There was a really interesting article in the Times about 1987, 88. Mm-hmm. And it said one of the reasons, I forget, it was a woman who wrote it. And she theorized that one of the reasons that the crack epidemic got so bad and was that women didn't want to, the heads of the household, women and their children in these, you know, inner city, weren't shooting up, but they were smoking. They were smokers. And so when crack came along and it was smoked, it didn't seem to be as dangerous as shooting up.
Right.
And so it was much more familiar to smoke. And people didn't know that they were going to be devastated.
Yeah, the barrier to entry of smoking something versus a needle in the arm is night and day. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And that affected that community. And the women who had sort of been keeping it together for their children and themselves
fell apart. You've been in the East Village
for a long time, 40 years now.
Wow. So you've seen all of these shifts.
Yeah.
You were here.
Yeah, in the
80s. Yeah.
And, crack, it was, you know, it was a pretty rough place. This takes place in 94.
Right.
And it's still pretty tough.
Still tough, yeah. I mean, I can see why. I mean, this isn't a bad cover.
No,
there's something very beautiful about it.
It is very beautiful with the, you know, using the fire escape and having this golden door, which I think Dranka, the editor, Dranka Willen, very famous editor at Harcourt, I asked her to make it even more golden.
Right, right.
So that it would pop more. But that, again, would not have been my choice for a cover. It was only when I worked with independent book publishers that I really have a say in what the cover looks like.
Yeah.
And No Lease on Life is not subtle in that way. It uses a lot of vulgarities, a lot of...
I mean, that first sentence already,
yes,
it's coming out the door.
So this is not right.
Well, I'm looking at this bookstore cover, and I almost want something like this drawing, this kind of rawness.
Yeah.
You know.
Could have been graffiti. It could have been, you know, No Lease on Life in graffiti, and that's all.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been great, hand-drawn.
Yeah, but you know, companies, large companies, they have their staffs. Yeah. They have their art department. They have, you know, and they don't want to give way, you know. They want to do what they want to do.
I think people on the outside of the industry are shocked when they hear that, you know, writers have so little... The majority of writers have so little say over.
Usually the contract will say it's written in such a way that you don't have authority.
Right, 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 right.
They have to show it to you.
Right.
And maybe you can get them to do something a little different. But usually not.
Right.
Oh, with Motion Sickness, when it first came out... my publisher, editor at Poseidon, didn't like the title. She said it makes me think of vomit bags.
Okay.
And she really didn't like the book. She said she really didn't like it. She published it, but she didn't really like it.
Strange.
It was strange. I mean, she was supportive of me as the writer, but she, you know, what's it about? And I said, well, you know... What's Camus' book about? What's, you know, The Stranger about? It's, where's the action?
Right.
I said, it's the same action throughout. It's this young woman traveling around and she's meeting others who are displaced. It's about displacement. It's about being in a foreign place and so on. So the first cover were these pictures that were like postcards, small. And they were going down like vomit, I thought. And I said, please, have the pictures go up.
Okay.
So, because I think she probably told the designer, it's not a bad cover. It's just, also, it could have been, I think, a better cover.
Yeah. Well, what do you make a successful cover? What, of these covers that you have here, what are your two or three favorites and why? This is just
gorgeous.
So good.
Yes,
so
Men in
good.
Apparitions, and this image is from the artist Susan Hiller, who is a very great friend of mine and who recently died. And when I was thinking about the cover, she had a show on, and this aura photograph was there. And it's very simple. So the designer got it, and he's Soft Skull's designer, and I'm forgetting his name, but it must be there too. I'm getting hungry, I have to say.
Me too.
Okay, so want some hummus?
Let's eat some nuts.
Okay, good. Thank you. Otherwise, I'm going to die. No, nuts are very good.
Nuts are the best snack. Mm-hmm. It's the thinking person's snack. So this cover, so to describe it for the listeners, is this aura, this multicolored, this kind of rainbow aura, and just the hint of
a
man.
Head. Yeah, a head, and you see the white collar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pinky, rosy pinky, rose pink, and white and some yellow, a yellowish tone, and some green. It's just beautiful.
Well, and just in really simple type.
Very simple.
And the title and your name are the same size.
And what I fought for
just
that
has this rhythm,
was they wanted to put a novel. And I said no.
Why?
Because it would ruin the beauty of this, yeah. I thought.
It's so elegant. This is simple. You'd think that to get to a place like this with a cover would be easy. But it never is.
No. But I was surprised it didn't win a design award. Mm. I just think that the designer, the way it works, it's just so beautiful. There's your picture again.
There you are. This is a different crop. Cover designed by Salu.io. So I don't know who that is. Salu.io. But you have a wonderful quote from Lydia Davis here. When I want to feel that my brain is alive and active, and when I want to laugh at the same time, laugh at something really intelligent and interesting, I read Lynn Tillman's stories.
Isn't that great?
From Lydia, yeah. But this is gorgeous, and it's your most recent. This came out last year, 2018.
And now they brought out a new edition of American Genius of Comedy.
Mm.
Which is what we, where is it?
Somewhere. Oh
here it
it's
is.
Under our, it's under our nuts.
It's under that. And what's beautiful about this is that this background was the same background on the first edition.
Yep.
Which was...
More zoomed out.
Yes. That was by Robert Gober. And the new cover is by Robert Gober. And he had done, in the gallery, Andy Hunter, who's the publisher-director of Catapult, which includes Soft Skull and Counterpoint, saw this. Gober had a new show, and he saw this, and with the apple there. And it's just a perfect for the new edition.
What's happening here on this cover? Like, if you were to describe this to someone, so there's an apple sitting there, there's even the sticker that's on the apple that you'd have in the supermarket.
These are... I believe the bottoms of legs, and they have fabric.
Yep.
And with American Genius of Comedy, fabric was very important, and skin. Mm. And I came upon this image. Gober and I, this really great artist, Robert Gober, were having breakfast. And at that time, we were looking, Richard Nash and I were thinking about what's our image for the cover. Mm-hmm. I said, you know, Bob, I need something, you know, I'm thinking about fabric, I'm thinking about skin. He said, oh, I have an image you might. That was it.
Well, I mean, there's like, this is almost like a sub theme to a lot of your work too, because I mean, so much of your writing is connected with the art world, art criticism. And in doing that, you've cultivated these really intimate relationships with all these wonderful artists. And then these kind of events happen.
That's right.
Where
it's very lucky.
It comes together. It's not, I think it's not lucky. It's
fortunate.
It's just what happens. It was meant to be. This cover was meant to come together in that way.
I'm so happy about it. And Gober is such a generous, wonderful man.
Mm.
I do know many wonderful people, I have to say. You know, when you think about how miserable things are and Trump and all that crap. And then you think about things in your own life, and there are wonderful things.
Yeah.
I think you have to focus sometimes on that.
So one of my favorite covers of your books is that another reissue, you know, or almost like a first publication, right?
In
because
a way,
it never really... Never really came out. This is the weird fucks book.
Right.
Which is such
my first longish work, 62 manuscript pages.
Right. What was the impulse for writing this book? And when was this?
I finished it in 1978. It was really the first longish thing I'd ever written. And it was published in 1980 in a punk magazine called Bikini Girl, which was pink. She only used pink. And it was about this wide.
Okay.
So it was really wide. And I thought that she was publishing this as a chapbook. But
oh,
no, no, it was in the magazine. It wasn't an issue devoted to this. Mm. And so 62 pages was reduced to 6 pages.
Oh, wow.
In something like 7-point type.
Yeah.
And spread across, you know, it was a long... I was so disappointed. You know that part in Spinal Tap where Stonehenge comes down?
Right.
And it's tiny?
Right.
That's what I felt.
I see. Yeah, no. That must have been, I mean, crushing. Mm-hmm. But New Herring, how did this come about? So how did New Herring Press get this and decide? I guess also another question here that I've kind of had running through the back of my mind is, how have you been archiving everything? Because you were using a computer, sounds like from maybe the mid-90s?
Yeah.
But this was pre-computer.
Yeah.
Was this a handwritten manuscript?
Yeah. No, it was typed.
Typed.
I never handwrote things.
And you were in Europe?
No, I wrote it. I came back.
You came back and wrote.
Right.
And so did you have that sitting around? You just had the manuscript?
Well, I had the... It was published again... after 1980, in a collection called Absence Makes the Heart, which I don't have. And they put it in there, but they published it in such a way that it was completely lost. And nobody ever mentioned it. But it came out in England, and of course maybe they just didn't want to mention it, who knows? So it, again, just sank. You know, nobody saw that. So I had copy. I mean, I had, you know.
So it was published in its entirety.
Again.
In that moment.
But then when I,
Makes the Heart.
But nobody had noticed it.
Right.
Sarah and Jess Arndt and Sarah Marcus and Jason Daniel Schwartz, they were the four new Herring people.
And Sarah Marcus was with us at McDowell, same Sarah Marcus.
That's right. And I suggested to them that they begin a little press. Mm. I mean, they hadn't begun it.
Yep.
And I met with, not Sarah Marcus, the other Sarah, Sarah Jaffe,
okay.
Sarah Jaffe, and Jess Arndt. And they were saying, well, how can we get published? And I said, well, there's a tried and true way, is you begin your own magazine, and then things happen.
Yeah.
So they did.
Yeah.
And indeed, things happened for both of them. Oh. Sarah Jaffe's book came out with Tin House.
Okay, great.
We were out in Colorado for an experimental writing conference, you know.
Sure.
I was a keynote speaker with Everett, Percival Everett.
Yeah.
And we got drunk one night. Sarah, Jess, and I forget how I said something. Oh, nobody ever read Weird Fox, and then either Jess or Sarah said, "Well, why don't we bring it out?"
Yeah,
I said, "You mean it?" She said, "Yeah."
Yeah,
and that was it.
Yeah, well, it's great. I mean, so this is
Amy Silman. That's her. Cover.
Yet again, this kind of art world connection.
Yeah. Yes.
And Amy Silman, true story behind this cover, my good friend Rob Giampietro was at the American Academy in Rome with Amy. And Amy came in one night and said, "Rob, help me get this text on top of the..."
I didn't know that.
So my friend Rob helped Photoshop the Weird Fox handwritten text on top of the art there. He's very happy to have been part of this, I think, to tell
that. Well, thank him.
But it's, it's this great kind of cover. I think it works. It's abstract. It's strange. It's as weird as the book itself.
It's beautiful. And then the imagery inside is gorgeous.
Yes. And this is also Amy's work?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Isn't that gorgeous?
It's so good.
It's such a beautiful book.
Well, and the quality of printing.
Is wonderful, isn't it?
So, yeah, it's...
They got money
really
from
great.
The
really
from well an art gallery, a nonprofit art gallery, applied for money to publish it.
So by this point, Lynn and I had been talking for about 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, and we were both pretty starving and getting a little antsy. And so we decided to stand up and do a little wander around Lynn's incredible East Village apartment. And let me just set the scene here. Her place is covered in incredible art, just everywhere. And so Lynn and I walked around her apartment for a little bit, and she narrated and explained the provenance of a lot of this beautiful, beautiful art that covers her walls.
Okay, so we're standing in the kitchen, and you have this kind of
salon style hanging.
So what's happening? You have this guitar over your sink.
Okay, that's so supposed to be. So my partner is David Hofstra, who's a bass player.
And so
I'm a writer. And Kiki Smith, who's a wonderful artist. We've been friends since 1978. And she made this for one of my birthdays.
Oh, wow.
It's, the bass looks like an odalisque.
Yes.
Isn't that beautiful? And that's a photograph by Susan Hiller. It's in a motel or hotel where she, it's called The Secret of, oh, I forget. And she projected kind of language onto the curtains window. Okay. That's an early work by Paul Chan, who also did this. Mm-hmm. This is by James Welling, who's a photographer. That's another Kiki Smith. This is a Portland artist called Eve. She's somebody I don't know, but I saw that work and...
Snapping away. Mm. Which one? The one in the middle with the telescope?
To me, it was so interesting. There's a kind of minimalism on a natural landscape. It's collage. This is a photograph from a piece by Sylvia Kolbowski.
Which one?
And she photographed people's hands as they were talking about conceptual art. So, and minimalism, where the hand isn't meant to show, but she had right. them. And it's a really beautiful work. This is by Barbara Probst, whose book I gave you. This is, of course, Nelson Mandela. This is a painting by Dana DiGiulio, whose work I really like. And this is a photograph of Primo Levi's living room. And this is a work by Barbara Kruger, who's also, I met her the same year I met Kiki, 1978. And I have a novella called To Find Words. And in the novella, the female character has a cough, and she's always touching her throat.
Oh, okay.
So then Barbara did that for me.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful? It's a one of a kind.
Wow. Ooh. I mean, it seems like photography is so important to you.
I also love paintings. We can go. I do love photography.
I mean, Men in Apparitions was a many, many, many year exploration of photography, wasn't it, in part?
This is by Ori Raff, and she photographed desktops.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's incredible.
This is by Sadie Benning, who's both a filmmaker and a... And she calls these, I believe, psychic portraits. And that was a psychic portrait of me. It was, she was thinking about me, and these are the images that came to mind. Yeah, yawn.
Look at Basie. Your cat is incredible. He's the biggest thing I've ever seen. Has Basie ever gone outside?
No. Well, he in Hudson.
Oh, you'll take him up sometimes.
Yeah, we take him up when we go up, and because we can't.
He's giving me a good sniff.
Yeah.
I know what that means.
Okay. So these paintings are by Peter Dreyer.
Yeah. I love how they're just sitting here.
Yeah. And this is a photograph by Anne Mee Lee. Oh, wow. She's a wonderful photographer.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful work?
It's so surreal.
Yeah. The Isn't it?
So where is this? Or what?
She was... She got permission to go on a one of those kinds of big ships.
A Navy ship?
Yeah.
This is the U.S. Navy?
Yeah. And this is a work, early work, by Barbara S. It's pinhole camera at Shea Stadium.
Oh.
Isn't that amazing?
And over how many years have you been acquiring...
Well, I guess it's maybe 30 years, I guess.
Many of these presents?
Yes.
Many of your presents?
I think pretty much the majority. That's Laurie Simmons, who has a survey show that just opened at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago. I went there. It's a great show. Cindy Sherman.
Yep.
Rebecca Quaitman.
And this is this your writing space? Your workspace? Everywhere is your writing space.
I basically now sit on that chair because I realize I don't like looking into that.
Into the wall.
I don't like looking into it.
What a collection of stuff, though. Of books.
I mean, here, this is what I wanted to give you.
Oh. Oh, wow.
And that, there's some really good photography in there.
Fantastic. Let's see here. Let's take the covers that you love and do a little photo shoot over on the... I'll do it on... We didn't do that. This is not it. Mm-hmm. This is a good cover, though.
I know. That was my idea.
And again, your face.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea was they wanted to do a portrait of me on this space. On this... I said, no. I said, no. And then I said, but I have an idea. If you want to use my face... And then I took these Polaroids.
I see.
And then wrote on it so you don't see my face.
when was this published?
2002.
Okay. There we go. This is good. This is a good selection.
Okay.
These are bold. Hummus. I lived in a house for 3 years where all we had was hummus in the fridge.
Really?
It was me and two other men. And all we had hummus and smoothies and a little bit of LSD in the freezer, I think.
You're kidding.
It was very weird. Very weird diet.
So where do you want to put them? Do you want to put them here?
Oh, well, how about in there?
On the bed?
The lighting's maybe a little,
okay.
A little softer.
Okay. However you want to
maybe
do
Maybe we
it.
Can put them around Basie.
Ha, ha, ha.
If Basie will let us. Basie. Basie is. Ah, you're amazing. You're the greatest cat I've ever seen. Oh my god. Oh! Sorry.
Did he hit you?
Yeah, sorry.
Basie!
But no claw. Is he declawed?
No.
Oh, but no claw. It was just it was just a pat.
He was just saying, you know, you're in my territory, man. Ah.
You're in my territory, man. Seems like a good place to end it. I let this one run kind of long because why not? Lynn is lovely, and the more Lynn in the world, the better. Just a gentle reminder, this podcast is made possible by the membership of people like you to the Explorers Club on craigmaud.com. If you enjoy this monthly podcast and want to send a very strong signal to me that you want more of it, please consider joining the Explorers Club. It goes a long way. More at craigmaud.com/membership. Today's episode was also sponsored by another entity, as these podcasts often are, and today's entity is Rent Control. a means of limiting the amount of rent charged on dwellings. How does this manifest in real-world change? Well, let me tell you, at its best, it creates vibrant communities encompassing all walks of life with all levels of commercially viable output. When you think of the greatness of New York City, in part, you're thinking of the effects of rent control, allowing artists and writers and musicians to congregate in dense urban environments to do the work they feel compelled to do, often together. So, thank you, rent control, for your many immeasurable contributions to our society and the arts, and the moral application of consciousness and life.